Hello and welcome to the 15th and final for 2018 season-ending wrap-up spectacular of the Whistleblowers. I'm News and Observer sports columnist Luke DeCock. With me, as always, former official and supervisor John Clockerty. John, we made it through the tournament. I did not go to the Final Four, neither did you. We were able to watch from the comforts of our home, or in my case, from Augusta, where I was down at the Masters. All things considered, the Final Four seemed like it went relatively smoothly. Your impressions from an officiating standpoint?
Well, no, I didn't go to the Final Four, and I think unless I go as a supervisor or as an official, my days of going to the Final Four are over. I'm not a big fan of crowds and 40,000, 50,000 people. And Luke, I think I've had my fill of the Final Fours. I think it's one of the great events, along with the World Series and certainly the NBA and the Super Bowl. But just as soon stay at home and relax and watch it on TV, which I did. But I thought the tournament was exciting. I think UMBC and Loyola and others that upset higher-seeded teams made for an exciting tournament. Disappointing if you're a fan of Virginia or Miami or, you know, some of our teams, ACC teams that were seeded higher that got beat. So, but if you're rooting for the underdog and Loyola and UMBC and others, it was exciting. I didn't think UMBC would go past their win over Virginia, but Loyola to get to the Final Four, I think raised some real eyebrows but you know, at the end of the day, Villanova was the best of in the tournament. They proved it. They won by double digits in the semifinals and in the finals. Seemed like they had a team that was unified and had all the pieces in the right places with a great, a terrific coach. And of course, DeVincenzo was spectacular. I think he was the best player of both teams, Michigan and Villanova. I saw some of the things he did that made him, to me, look like an absolute star.
Yeah, I saw Villanova play live in Pittsburgh the first two rounds when I was there with Duke, and that was just a relentless machine of a basketball team that did very little wrong, just efficient and confident and talented. Just the degree to which they did everything well was really striking. And, you know, that was they were sharing that site with Duke, which at that point was playing some of the best basketball it had played all year. And I think from a raw talent perspective, there's no question that Duke might have been, I'll say Duke was a more talented team than Villanova, although Villanova is a very talented team, but, you know, the raw talent that Duke had, but Villanova is a better basketball team. And obviously there's some talent, you know, there's probably three or four first-round picks on that Villanova team. Just so impressive seeing that live, just how well Virginia did everything it does. It was eye-opening.
You know, Luke, I felt the same way. And I saw Villanova. My son Tim had the finals of the Big East tournament, and Providence took Villanova into overtime for that win. But sometimes when you play a team a lot, like Providence had probably played Villanova probably twice before that, and you learn how to play a team. But still, Villanova, one of the things that, and I've spoken on this subject before, is Villanova takes care of the ball. They have the best point guard probably, and they limit their empty possessions. They don't come running down there and try to make a spectacular play to get on Sports Center. They take care of the ball. They run their offense. They play defense. And, you know, so many teams that I watch through the tournament and during the regular season have 18, 20, 20-some plus turnovers. Each one of those turnovers is an empty possession, and it doesn't give you a chance to score. It gives the other team an opportunity for a breakaway. I just think Villanova wanted to make sure or played like, you know, these are possessions that we want to take care of the ball and see if we can score. And again, I'm not going to mention the teams that I see, but too many of them play reckless and just throw the darn ball away.
Yeah, you do see that. One ACC official made the Final Four, the 10 for the Final Four. Roger Ayers worked one of the semifinals. But four total from the ACC Big East Cooperative. Jeffrey Anderson, Michael Stevens, and Mike Roberts all made it as well. So good representation from the co-op, if not necessarily the ACC itself. We discussed this on our last podcast, John, because it was a topic of interest in the middle of the NCAA tournament. But we've gotten several questions since then on less about what happened and more of, is this a good idea? But, you know, Ted Valentine not working the tournament at all. John Higgins and Doug Shouse didn't get another tournament game after the wrong free throw shooter in the Auburn College of Charleston game. So those are, you're taking three officials who have worked Final Fours in the past, and you're taking them out of the mix for the second weekend and Final Four. We all understand why that is, or at least we understand why it was done this year, or we've been told why if we don't necessarily understand or agree. But what would you do if you were in charge? Are these technical errors so severe as to rule out using good officials later in the tournament? You know, is the same thing to a lesser extent with Ted Valentine, but you know, how would you approach some of this stuff? Do officials understand that's just the way it is? And what would you do?
Well, they understand it now, because J.D. Collins, the national coordinator, has set the ground rules. And I'm going to do two things. First of all, you mentioned some very good officials that refereed the semifinals and the finals. I know all of those except for one official, but they are deserving. They are all very, very good referees. And I told you when it first came out that I thought that the selections were excellent. I didn't see none of them are bad referees, but I didn't see any referee that I didn't think wasn't deserving. They were experienced. They brought some new faces in. I thought the NCAA did a really good job of covering the semifinals. To answer your question, Luke, is I always felt, and in the past, in the first round or first or second games, a referee should be an experienced referee should be given the benefit of the doubt. If he catches a bad game and he's off a little bit, I don't think that official who has experience and has proven himself through the season and in other NCAA tournaments should be sent home because he had a rough night or the game didn't have any flow. You could still advance that guy, even though in everybody's eyes, maybe he was off a little bit. But he has a proven record. The other thing is, the J.D. Collins, and I was the supervisor when he laid this down, if you make an error in rules, you didn't apply the rule correctly, or if you make a mental error simply because you weren't focused, then you are going to be sent home. Your question was, do you hurt the tournament? I think you hurt the tournament in the first, second, and third rounds by sending a Doug Shouse, John Higgins, and Ted Valentine home. I think you do get in a situation where you would like to have those. But Doug Shouse and John Higgins, when they realized or were told that they had the wrong free throw shooter at the line, They knew that they were going to go home. They weren't going to advance. But getting back, yes, I think you take those three guys out, it doesn't hurt the Final Four, because you're going to have a pool of referees that are, that measure the same level as Charles Higgins and Valentine. Mike Stevens and Jeff Anderson and Roger Ayers and Doug Sermons and Randy McCall, they're at that level. So you're not going to damage the semifinals and the finals. But you need those guys, I think, as the tournament moves on, you need those guys that have Final Four. I think there's it weakens the tournament. But J.D. Collins says, you are not, you got three guys out there, you should never miss a rule. And under any circumstance, you've got the monitor, you've got a standby who has a rule book, you have all, you are covered. And then to put the wrong free throw shooter with three officials out there at the line, that's inexcusable. Can't do it. You're getting sent home. And I have no argument with that. Again, does it affect? It could affect, because you'd like to have Higgins, Valentine, and Schultz as your referees in some of those games. But it doesn't hurt the Final Four, I don't think.
The other big issue coming out of the, or I should say question, coming out of the tournament that people were asking about were replays, and specifically replay delays. There were a couple really lengthy reviews in various games, and some of them it was a almost a 50-50 when you saw the video. Did the finger move? Did the ball deflect? What at what point are we getting too caught up in blowing up frames and all of that stuff, and just need to kind of live with some of these calls and move on?
It's a good point, and it certainly is something that that I think frustrates fans and viewers. When the officials go over to look at those plays, some of the plays are easy, Luke, and you pointed out the most difficult one, the tip ball, but the 3-2, that one's easy, or do you have the right free throw shooter? That's easy. Some of the ones that come down, did the ball get off in time? That picture is going to help you to determine whether that basket's good or not good. The tip ball is so crucial now in the last couple minutes, and you called them 50-50. I have seen a couple that I would have said they're not overturning that, or they're going to overturn it, and they come back and they don't overturn it because they had already made a decision on the floor and there's not enough evidence, indisputable evidence. And the other thing is, there are times that the official is doing his what I call the look. He has a swivel there that he's looking at the play. He's looking at something that the audience is not looking at. The audience, the TV network may have, is giving them a different feed, but the officials are not looking at it. But they want to get that play right, so they're taking time. But it seems like an exorbitant amount of time, and it gets to be frustrating, even to the coaches, because now the coaches have their team over there, they're talking strategy, but it breaks the rhythm up the game. If you go to the monitor far too many times, it breaks all the rhythm up. Plus, you got all these TV timeouts that we've talked about.
And which is worse in the NCAA tournament than it
oh,
is.
Oh, yeah, yeah, because they talk about 90 seconds, but it's not 90 seconds.
No,
it's
I don't think a single one was under 2 minutes.
2 minutes. They're all 2 minutes. So you can't, as a team, you can't get any rhythm. You can't get going. But now you've got monitored delays. I saw one that measured up to a minute and a half or so. And I know the committee wants you to get in there and get out, but for them to give the ball to the wrong team, but I saw one that And it always happens on a rebound where a couple guys are going after it, and there's one hand here, and his hand's on the ball, and the next thing you know, there's another fingertip on the ball. And they don't want to come out of there without making the right decision, but sometimes the decisions are just impossible. But, Luke, if they start expanding the monitor anymore, I think it's going to be detrimental. There's too many stoppages now.
Yeah,
I mean, there's so many stoppages.
Well, and you know, my feeling on it, like the way I think it should be done, is you should get a certain amount of time, and if you can't see an obvious change or an obvious affirmation in that period of time, then you just live with it. You go over there, you start the clock, you live with it. Now, I understand there's two problems with that. One is you as an official, you're getting different replays from DV Sport, mm-hmm. you know, from the company that does the monitors, than CBS may be showing. So CBS may be showing a clear-cut angle that shows a clear deflection, and you may not get that angle in the first 30 seconds. And then they're going to kill you showing that replay and saying, how'd they get this wrong? Which is why you end up there for 2 minutes going through other replays and then going back and forth. So also, you know, you want to spend enough time there to get it right, because if you do get it wrong, you know, then you're, you know, they're going to show that replay over and over again, which, you know, the national title game last year, they showed the replay over and over again of the guy touching the ball with his hand out of bounds, which, you know, no one saw, which wasn't a replay issue, but, you know, it's a hard play to officiate because you're not watching the guy's outstretched arm behind the play on the baseline. But, you know, it becomes an example or everyone criticizes, oh, how could you ever miss this?
Well, just to add to that, there was a play that involved Syracuse last year where one of the referees came out far out of his position and called a player saying that he had his foot on the baseline and turned the possession over, and the player, when they replay it, now that's not a reviewable play.
Right.
And everybody on the monitor and every place saw that his foot was not on the line. Mm-hmm. And again, it was, if you start and say, okay, there's a question whether his foot was on the line, and the official called his foot on the line, but there's a jumbotron or an overhead showing that his foot's not on the line, that's not a reviewable play. Do we want to expand it to that? You know, it's just too many stoppages.
Yeah, I I'm anti-replay. Some people aren't. I am. You know, I feel like if you don't see it right away, then let's move on. And I'd also be okay, like, especially in football, you know, let's just live with the call. Now, there are certain things like, is it a two or a three? You know, do we have the right free throw shooter? You know, things like that. Like, where replay obviously can operate quickly and serves a definite purpose. There's no doubt about that. But some of this out of bounds stuff, the block charge stuff,
the restricted area.
Yeah, the restricted area stuff. I would just as soon say let's live with it and move on. Now, I do think it's the who touched a ball going out of bounds is so hard to tell from video sometimes. Did the guy step on the baseline? That's easier to tell. Like mm-hmm. that to me is something that if there's a question about that, you know, that's, you know, that should be more revealed. It's almost like these targeting calls in football where they go upstairs and you're rolling the dice.
Yeah,
you know, it's the same thing that's happened in hockey with these goaltender interference reviews and offsides reviews where they're, you know, you're judging offside. If a guy's skate was off the ice, there's camera angles that are going to create a deceptive, there's something called the parallax effect, where if a guy's skate is off the ice, it may look like it's on one side of the line when it's not, actually. It becomes this almost arbitrary standard. I think the NHL with goaltender interference reviews and the NFL with catch reviews have the same problem, which mm-hmm. is they're trying to apply a concrete standard to something that is essentially arbitrary. Like, the rule on a catch should be you know a catch when you see one.
Mm-hmm.
And instead, you know, you've got, you know, them going frame by frame to see when the ball was moving and when it wasn't. Same thing with goaltender interference. You should know goaltender interference when you see it. These things shouldn't be reviewable. Mm-hmm. They should be what you see on the field. Now, obviously, if a guy traps the ball, same as in baseball, you know, you want to get that right. But I'm just generally anti-replay. I'd prefer to trust the officials that and live with it if they miss one. But I do understand from an official's perspective, you'd rather take the time at the monitor to make the best call you can, rather than be criticized down the road for not doing it if you get it wrong.
You know, now, there was a time where they didn't have any review in baseball.
Yeah.
And, you know, now they've expanded that to the first base. Does a guy come off the base and it's second base? And, Luke, I'm afraid that they may even take the strike zone and start looking at balls and strikes. I hope it never happens, you know, but with technology the way it is and being able to superimpose a strike zone, umpires are calling balls strikes and strikes balls.
What about an automated strike zone?
You know, I read something about that where there were some advocates for automatic strike zone. I just don't think you can take the human error. I mean, if you're going to do that, then the next step is take the umpires off the field. Take them all off the field because you got replay that will tell you, I mean, instantly tell you whether his foot was on the bag or off the bag, and now you got a strike zone. Are we going to blink our eyes and in 20 years see no officials or 10 years umpires? I mean, that sounds outrageous, but I have read that there are people that would be in favor of a, what you call it, automatic strike zone, or
I mean, there's a bunch of ways to phrase it, but I would say automate the strike zone. Basically, yeah. Just have a, you know, you, yeah, same thing as you do in tennis with line calls.
Yeah,
you know, when you review a line call,
there you go.
You know, you can do that, yeah, with baseball.
Yeah. So I don't think the players, and I don't think the umpires, of course, would be in favor of that, but It's not out of the realm that is down the road at some point in time that might happen.
Yeah, I don't think we will or ever should or will ever get rid of umpires, because it's still quicker to have a human make some of those decisions on, you know, even if you do or don't go back and replay some of them. But I'm coming to the idea of an automated strike zone just because the arbitrariness of the strike zone for any given umpire. I think if you had an automated strike zone, you could set it each season at whatever you want, and it might speed games up a little bit. I'm not gonna,
yeah, lie. You know, I would hope there'd be better ways to speed the game up than that. But, you know, I saw a play. This is early in the season. I don't think it was the Pirates opener, but the Pirates were playing, and there was a walk-off run come in, and there was a tag at home plate that said the guy was safe. And everybody's celebrating, and the dugout empties, and they're all celebrating on the field, and they reviewed it, and they overturned it,
yep,
which means the game had to go into extra innings.
And the Tigers lost that game.
And the coach got tossed. Okay.
And then Major League Baseball came out a few days later and said they got the review wrong.
Oh, did they? I didn't,
yeah,
know that.
Yeah, no, they said that should have been safe.
I did.
I'm 99% sure, yeah, that, sure, the Tigers got an apology from Major League Baseball,
yeah,
on that.
So, you know, like, I would have been, I'm a Pirate guy, so I,
no,
was,
not,
yeah,
yet.
And I was happy to see that, and then we win. But you know what? I would have also been happy. I'm not happy, but I would have said, okay, he got tagged out. That's how it goes. Don't go to the replay. He got tagged out. And the umpire did his job. But anyway.
I don't know.
Do we go? I mean, that's the question. All these replays, baseball, basketball, football, maybe it's too much.
Hockey. I think so. And I realize I'm probably in the minority on that. But I say, with certain exceptions, I think there's obvious uses for replay. Things that can be, mm-hmm, looked at. Errors that can be corrected and quickly, and in that case, it's fine. But I'm a less replay guy. Live with it. Live, yeah, with it. These guys, umpires, officials, referees, they're human.
You know, Luke, I'm like you a little bit, but I'm old school, and I refereed Final Fours and games, and there were misses, and we moved on, and didn't have all those. Those questionable calls being reviewed.
Yeah. We're still dealing with listener questions here, which is great. One other thing that a couple people asked about, and I actually responded to them directly, but we can talk about it very briefly. The couple people said, how could Roger Ayers move on to the Final Four when he clearly got that block charge call wrong at the end of the Kansas game? To which I responded, if the NCAA thought he got it wrong, they wouldn't have advanced him. But what was your take on that?
Yeah, no, I saw the play. I thought he got it wrong. Okay. And actually, I talked to Roger, and I wished him well, and I hoped that he would advance. I think the defender took it in the chest. The kid from Duke, Carter, took it in the chest. And you can always find minimal movement in the defender. He's not going to. I don't think he's ever going to be completely stationary. I guess sometimes they are. But I thought it was a very close play. And I would say the committee saw the play and thought he had it right. Okay. And the evaluators thought he had it right. And I think that puts him in a favorable position to move on. And he did. But had it been an obvious miss, a terrible miss, then I think it would have worked against him. But he came out there, called it. I don't know what happened behind the scenes, but Coach Krzyzewski looked puzzled on it, like he thought, as every coach would, thought it was a charge. But when I first saw it, my first instinct says that kid took it. That was a good play by the defense. But I was wrong. I guess they thought it was right.
Yeah, I think you can make the argument that Carter did kind of lean into the contact, but I thought at the time it was kind of a definition of a 50-50 call. It was going to be whatever you think it is at the time it happens. It was interesting, and John, I don't know if you saw this, but I was talking with Wendell Carter about it after the game. I didn't even ask him about it. I asked him about the idea of trying to take the charge because he had four fouls, and you know that's a tough, gutsy play to take there. And he said, you know, he had done the same thing against Florida State, and it had changed the momentum. This is in the regular season. Had changed the momentum of that game. And Malik Newman was killing Duke at that point. And here's what he said. He said, this is Duke's Wendell Carter. I thought that was the perfect opportunity to give our team the ball. I just thought that was my moment. The ref made a fantastic call. No matter what I think, how I felt about it, he made the right call. I have respect for that call. So that was an interesting to hear a player say that. I don't know whether he agreed with the call, but I think what I took away from that was that's a pretty ballsy call to make in those circumstances, and I took a risk, and I have to live with that as a player.
Yeah, you know, nobody's going to criticize him for trying to make the play, but I will certainly praise him for his comments about the referee – made a good call, fantastic, you know.
And let me just jump in and say he did not have a sarcastic tone in it.
No, of course not. No, he was not being sarcastic. When I read that, I thought, wow, that kid's got it together. And I because there would be so many times that the comment would be different than that, you know, like something to the effect that it was a bad call. But he didn't say that, and that certainly also could. I don't know how quickly you talked to him afterward, but that could have contributed to Roger's favor, a comment like that.
Okay? Maybe.
So maybe. I don't know. And that really doesn't matter, but that was pretty classy of that kid to say that.
Yeah. The question was, how can a guy advance when he clearly gets that wrong? And the answer was, obviously, the committee
didn't think it was wrong.
So, and you know, to a certain extent, on a play like that, I'm not sure you can make a conclusive case either way that it was right or wrong. But he was decisive and called what he thought he saw, and we move on.
Let's go back to I thought it was the other way, but it's a 50-50, and it was really hard. And you said the guy looked like he leaned in, and I think he leaned in too, but I also didn't think he moved his feet. But it doesn't matter. I mean, Roger took a shot at it, and that's the best you're going to get at that play. He didn't swallow his whistle. That play needed a whistle. You couldn't pass on that play, and Roger thought it was a block.
That's a great point. You're not the, there's no no call there.
No, there's no, you got to make a call.
All right, so one other thing we want to talk about. The NIT used some experimental rules this year. Playing in quarters, international three-point line, wider lane. I know your son Tim worked an NIT game in New York. Just curious if there was anything you noticed, anything you thought out of that those rule changes that caught your eye, or you think is worth bringing along.
Well, what I would advocate is them not moving the three-point line to the international line. I listened to Vitale go off about it, but the positive side, and we'll talk about that line first of all, the positive on that is that when a team is behind and they can get back into the game and make the game exciting by nailing some threes and limiting the possessions that they have to have. But would you start moving that line back? This is still college, not the NBA. It's not the international. And scoring, if you want to increase scoring and keep the game exciting, I think they ought to keep the line. I think the line was too short at one point. I think it was 19-9. They moved it back a foot. But I like the line where it is because I think it gives some teams that can shoot the three get back into the game. Plus, there's a place for guys that are sharpshooters. Maybe they don't have the whole game. Maybe they're not a driver, or they can't sky like some players. But their skill is a three-point shooter. That player still has a place in the game when you put him where the line is now. You can get him open and he can help you shoot in threes. I like the quarters. I like going back to the quarters. I think along with that, they're dealing with the fouls, the number of fouls in each quarter. I don't know, Luke, the entire rules. I haven't looked at them. So I think going to the quarters, Tim liked it. My son Tim, when he refereed it, he liked it, but I don't know if the NCAA is, or if the NIT is just experimenting with it, or if that's in their plans to go to quarters and moving the line. I don't have a feel for widening the lane. I know in general, and this is just like crazy, I know, but I think the way the players have grown, that the floor 94 by 50, it seems like this floor is too small for the size of the players that we have now. I know that's not going to change. That's never going to be a consideration. But when you look at the floor 50 and you put a Syracuse zone out there, the floor looks narrow. Widen the lane is going to be put in so there's not so much physical play in the lane. And I don't think widening that lane is going to stop the big guys from being physical. I think that's just one. And it opens up the lane for drivers, gets the lane open, easier to drive to the hoop without the big guys in there. I think there's a lot of work still to be done before they start widening the lane. But I like the quarters, and I like the three-point line where it is.
I'm not a fan of quarters. I the halves is something I like about the college game. But I will acknowledge that the game of basketball globally and at every level is a quarters game. Mm-hmm. High school, women's basketball, NBA, mm-hmm. international. So that's something that, you know, it's hard to make the argument that college basketball is so unique that it needs to be played, and men's college basketball is so unique that it needs to be played in halves. But I like halves, so I'm a mixed feeling. I like the wider lane for all the reasons that you said. I think it just creates more space on the floor, especially the way, in a lot of ways, that the NBA has become more perimeter oriented. You know, college basketball is heading that way. I think widening the lane will help with that. I'm not saying that there's any connection between the NBA having a wider lane and the game becoming more perimeter oriented. I think that's a function of what players are good at these days and what wins, to be perfectly honest. But I think potentially going to an NBA or international style lane in college basketball could help that process along. So the 3-point line, I go either way. I do think that we're getting, college basketball has become so heavily reliant on the 3-pointer that moving it back a little bit will maybe diversify the game a little bit. If you look at this, I did some research, just some quick research, the first 2 weekends of the NCAA tournament, so 52 games, I think. 52 games. The team that shot a better percentage from three, that's it, not number of threes, not attempted, not anything else, better percentage from three, won, I think, off the top of my head, 50 of those 58 games. And of the other eight, there were no upsets, meaning the better team presumably won. College basketball is, if you look at teams that lost, teams that were upset, almost always they shot a poor percentage from three. Including Virginia versus UMBC, including, Duke's loss to Kansas, North Carolina against Texas A&M. It college basketball, to a certain extent, has become a 3-point shooting contest. You look at Villanova. One of the things that they do really well, shoot the three. One of the things Michigan does better than anybody is defend the 3-point line
and shoot the three.
And shoot the three, and sure. Defend the 3-point line well as anybody in the country. So, and then, of course, last year you look at North Carolina with its two big guys and say, oh, it's, you can still win inside. And, trends are trends, whatever. But I do feel like when you watch college basketball games now, if you take a step back, it really is a 3-point shooting contest. Now, there are a lot of variables that go into how well a team shoots from three, whether it's how well the other team defends or the offense you run or your players, or you get a lot of offensive rebounds. And it's not the only thing in the game. That's not what I'm saying. But I think results, to me, are increasingly determined by 3-point shooting above all else. And to a certain extent, that's what you've seen in the NBA. Of course, if that were the only thing that mattered, Oklahoma would have tried to win the national title. But, it seems like, and it is over-determining which
you
team
think
wins.
It's over the...
I think it's just become too big a part of the equation, maybe. Okay. Or maybe not. Maybe that's just the way the game of basketball worldwide is trending. It's a shooter's game now. But I think that when you look at the teams in the tournament that lost before you thought they would, almost all of them, and maybe all of them, I'd have to go back and look, were had off shooting nights from three.
Yeah.
Gotta make shots.
Yeah, but let's flip that just a little bit, because I think that's interesting. How about the teams of lesser talent that you would think lower seeded, lesser talent, that won games because of the three?
Sure.
Okay. That puts them gives them not an equal chance, but a chance to win the game, because they've got two or three players that can shoot from behind the line. And I think schools like, and I don't have the statistic, but I'm going to say Loyola, okay? Maybe they'll recruit, because they are Loyola, the guys that can shoot it behind the line, because now we can compete, because I got three guys that can shoot it. I thought Villanova's big guys.
Oh, yeah.
Shot it from behind the line like that. How do you defend that?
Well, like the Martin twins from Nevada.
From Nevada.
Yeah.
So, the other thing is, Luca, why is there always so much emphasis on games being entertaining because the scores are high, 70, 80, 90 points, when I think the game could be extremely entertaining and be in the 50s?
I would agree with that.
I hear too much negative about teams that keep, especially Virginia, who I love watching play, and I know they had a bad tournament, but I just think defense, taking care of the ball, and relying on, which Virginia didn't do, making some threes and keeping the score in the 50s or 60, it that doesn't add up to being a less entertaining game?
We talked a little bit earlier about general impressions of the NCAA tournament, but we wanted to narrow in a little bit on Villanova because you mentioned that. When you look at the Final Four in particular, but Villanova in general, what stood out for you about Villanova and kind of the games that they won?
I thought, I just thought every position had a really good player. I thought their big kids were athletic, and you had to take they would take you away from the hoop and guard you, and they also could rebound. They were not overly tall, but athletic, could get up there so quick. Sometimes quickness, Luke, is better than size. Sometimes if you're quick to the ball, you know, and this is a tough comparison, but a Dennis Rodman leads the NBA at 6'7", 6'8", year after year because he's quick to the ball and he knows how to position himself. I thought Villanova the inside players were quick to the ball, and then you had to defend them. But it all came down to their leader for the most part through the tournament. They may have had the best leader in Brunson, who was just an extension of his coach on the floor. He deserved to be the player of the year in every category. Wasn't a great scorer, although he was more than an adequate scorer, but he delivered the ball. He kept the team motivated. I mean, when you have a great leader, and then maybe the best player, and I talked Brunson about being a great leader. His dad was a terrific player.
Oh, yeah. I watched him in college.
Yeah, and I refereed his dad, and his dad plays just like his dad played at Temple. They were identical. But then you have...
Let me just jump in
here
to
please,
say that
please.
The fact that John Chaney's Temple teams never made a Final Four is one of the great curiosities and injustices in the history of college basketball.
I agree. I had them when they beat Georgetown. I think when Georgetown had Allen Iverson, I remember the game, but I thought Temple was, that game was played in Hartford, Connecticut, and I remember because I had teed Coach Chaney up, but it was a great game.
Jalen Brunson does play like this.
Yeah, and then you have a guy like DiVincenzo, who comes off the bench, plays 37 minutes, blocks shots, makes shots from way out. You can't guard him. He's just, and I don't know if it was Jay Billis or one of those guys saying, clearly the kid's a professional. He's the best player on either team, and that included Brunson and the other Villanova terrific guys. But DiVincenzo's got special qualities about he skies and blocks a shot two-handed. He blocks a shot into the backboard that sticks between the ring. Then he scores 31 points as a sub. So I'm going on and on and on about Villanova, but they had all the parts, and all the parts came together at the right time. They weren't undefeated, and they probably were not as good in January or in February, but they were really good and great to watch. But nobody could argue. You made a point. Did Duke have Carter and Bagley and Duvall? Were they more talented? Yeah, probably. But were they a better team? No.
Now, interesting. Jalen Brunson came into Villanova as a potential one and done player. Won a national title as a freshman.
Yeah.
You know, stuck around for 3 years. Won another one. So you know that was a guy who kind of came into college maybe not expecting to stick around very long and ended up winning, you know, two national titles in his career, which is pretty impressive.
Yeah.
Some changing of the guard in the ACC, one coaching change already. Jeff Cable for Kevin Stallings at Pitt. I mean, not that you're a University of Pittsburgh guy, but you're a Pittsburgh guy. What was your sort of take on that hire, and what were your interactions like with Jeff when he came back to Duke, or even at Oklahoma, if you dealt with him at all there?
I didn't deal with him at Oklahoma, but I did deal with him at VCU. And I can tell you what my referees think of Jeff Cable. They think he is a terrific guy. I can speak for myself, but the referees always felt that Jeff Cable was fair, and if he would take an issue in the officiating, he didn't beat it to death. He made it known, and then he moved on. But Jeff Cable, I've had some, as the supervisor and him being an associate head coach at Duke, I had some interaction with him, and I've made this public only to friends and people such as yourself that we do things. I think Pitt made an excellent hire in Jeff Cable. I just think, I'm not sure they could have got a better guy. He's got to be Pitt. He can't be Duke, because Pitt's got to do it a different way than Duke. And Jeff will understand that, okay? But he knows all the AAU industry, the whole coaches. He'll get good kids in there, kids that'll battle. He'll become competitive. It may take a while because the cupboard is pretty bare right now. But he is an excellent choice for Pitt. And I just think I wish him well. He was always very engaging when I would go over to Duke. He would be out on the floor with the warm-ups. Coach K would be back in the office, and Jeff would spend some time and talk to me, and it was always a pleasant experience. I like Jeff Cable. You've probably had some things with Jeff and talk to him from time to time. Your opinion, I'd like to know, but if I could tell the people at Pitt I think they hired a great guy, I would, because I think he did.
Well, number one, you just like him because he's a Steelers fan.
Well, that's big. That's important.
People say, why did he take this job and not others? And I say, well, he's a Steelers fan.
The Steelers wrote him a personal letter.
Maybe.
They did. I thanked him.
So the, you know, there's that. And also, you know, the fact that, you know, he'd been dealing with his dad's illness for a while, and his dad passed away last fall. And, you know, maybe he felt a little more free to move away from home and away from North Carolina, you know, with that mm-hmm. off his shoulders, or maybe doesn't want to take on the responsibility of being a head coach while you're dealing with that as a son and not knowing, you know, how long that's going to take and being a difficult process. So, you know, all of that goes into it. But I agree. I mean, I think that's a much better hire than I thought Pittsburgh could make. And, you know, why now and why Pitt, you know, really only Jeff knows, but there are some obvious reasons why it makes sense. And you know, I mean, John, you and I are old enough to remember, and well, it really wasn't that long ago. It was 5-6 years ago, you know, when Pitt was a you know, single digit, you know, seed in the NCAA tournament, all that. So it, you know, that's not a program that's fallen off the face of the map as bad as the basketball has been the last couple of years, and you know, some mistakes and miscues by the administration there, but good facilities. You know, I think, you know, a little bit like the Carolina Hurricanes here, a fan base that's dormant, not dead, you know, that
that's
will come back to life
with
a little positive reinforcement, and a place where people have been able to win in the past, whether it's Ben Howland or Jamie mm-hmm. Dixon or whoever. So, or, you know, going back to Paul Evans before that. So your pal.
Yeah, no.
So you know, it's there's some history there. You're not starting from scratch. So, you know, a really good hire for Pitt, and we'll see how Cable does there.
I'm going to throw this out, and maybe do you think the move with Jeff Cable from Duke to Pitt was anything regarding that Jeff Cable would not be the next head coach at Duke?
You know, with Duke, there's so much criminology involved. There's really only one person's opinion who matters about that, and mm-hmm. nobody on the outside is ever gonna know what he's really thinking. You know, I if Jeff Capel had been promised the job at one point, you know, we'll never know. I think there's no question people on the outside saw him as a short-term successor for Krzyzewski, meaning if while Capel was there, if Krzyzewski had some sort of health issue, as he had, that required Capel to step in as the interim coach, you know, that if he had some sort of health issue that caused him to step down permanently, that Capel would step in, and that was part of one of the advantages of having Capel on the staff. This may mean that, you know, Krzyzewski has another couple of years in him, or feels like he does. It may mean that someone like Chris Collins has elevated himself to a position where, you know, there's that he's considered, or it may be a wide open race, or there may be someone else we're not even thinking about. So, you know, no one really knows what's really going on over there. I think it does raise some questions about that, because when you look at Georgia Tech or Arizona State, those are, to me, opportunities that were more appealing to me.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not a Steelers fan. you know, but I don't, you know, I don't have, knock on wood, don't have any health issues with my dad to deal with. So, you know, those to me made more sense for Jeff Capel. Maybe they weren't the right move for him at the time. Maybe, you know, that he never had the opportunity. But for whatever reason, the circumstances were right now. How much of that is internal at Duke? And, you know, the other part of it is, you know, that I think that we won't know the answer to this for a long time. And maybe even Kay doesn't know the answer is, you know, Jeff Capel has been not the only guy, but a big reason behind Duke's recruiting success the past few years, bringing in these number one ranked recruiting classes, the top three players in the class next year. You know, does this signal a move away from that sort of thing for Duke? You know, that,
yeah.
You know, it's an idle thought that keeps wandering through my brain. You know, just because Mike Krzyzewski knew that Duke had to play zone last year to be successful, doesn't mean he liked it.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean he enjoyed it.
No.
And I think getting mocked by Grant Hill on national television during a regional final,
yeah.
You know, that here's a guy who you know, did as much as anyone, and a player that did as much as any player to build, you know, probably him and Leitner and Hurley and Battier and a couple other guys. I mean, this is Grant Hill we're talking about here. When he's kind of laughing at you on national TV, slapping the floor in the zone, you know, does that sting a little bit more coming from him than it would someone else? And does that make it easier for Jeff to say, all right, well, I'm going to go hang up my own shingle again than it would otherwise? You know, I don't know. I can't imagine that won't particularly, you know, who knows? Maybe Kay shrugs that off and moves on. But for me, having someone like Grant Hill mock my program on national TV and what it's become would sting a little bit.
Yeah.
Now, the flip side of that is, however many more years Mike Krzyzewski may be coaching Duke, and who knows how long that'll be, it's not going to be 10, I don't think. You know, I don't think he's going to be coaching until he's 90 or 80.
80.
But, you know, there is a limited window here. That's unavoidable. How long it is, only he knows. But do you have time to retool your program at this point and try to win with, you know, change the way you recruit and try to recruit guys who will stay for two or three or four years? And, that, you know, they've had guys they thought would stay for a couple of years who haven't stayed, whether it was a Luke Kennard or a Frank Jackson or whatever. But you can recruit Derek Thornton, recruit guys you think, oh, here's a guy who can come in and stay for a couple of years, and then they don't. But, you know, I don't know if there's time to retool the way that program's running right now on the fly at this point in his career. Maybe there is, and maybe that's not something he wants to do at all. Maybe Duke will win a national title next year with these three guys and Tyus Jones' little brother, and this conversation everyone's having now will be forgotten.
Forgotten. The one thing you pointed out, if I had a cup of coffee with Jeff Capel, I think that it's somewhere he'd say, you know, I just needed to have my own program. I needed to, and Pitt was the best place for me, better than Arizona State and better than Georgia Tech. Pitt was a better place for me. And I needed to have my own program again. And the other thing is, even if Jeff Capel was positioned to follow Coach K, maybe in his mind said, that's not a good situation. Me following John Wooden, or me following Bill Belichick, or me following Coach K. You know, I'm not sure the next guy needs them. That whoever it is, Chris Collins, Wojciechowski, man, following Coach K at Duke, I think would not be an easy thing to do.
No, and it's also possible that Capel saw the writing on the wall and saw he had a couple years to go out and prove what he learned, you know, for in his second go around as a head coach, and
oh, he'll be better now.
Yeah, and still have time to, you know, to come back and take that job or get that job if that's what it comes to. But, you know, he never had any. There was never any secret about it. He wanted to be a head coach again, and this is an opportunity. So, one last thing to address very briefly, John. The other changing era in the ACC. We talked about this last time. Tim Nestor not coming back. There's a couple. Sort of workhorse officials over the years who are getting older. How do you think Brian Kersey will handle replacing Nestor and maybe bringing in one or two guys in a bigger role next year?
Yeah, I think Kersey has a envious position because he is the ACC. The ACC, in many people's eyes, is the premier place to referee. For officials to referee. So for him to go out and get Lee Cassell, get Teddy Valentine, get Ron Groover, get the next guy, it is not a real hard challenge for Brian Kersey. So he's going to pinpoint the guys that he thinks are really, really good, bring them in, scoop them from other conferences, whether it's the SEC or the American Conference. He's not going to mess with the Big East guys simply because the Big East got terrific referees and they're part of the alliance. So he doesn't have to go there. But he can identify, and there'll always be, because of Paul Brazo, he'll always have Brazo's support, and they'll always look for young, fairly young guys. You know, I think there's a referee that referees in the ACC as a secondary, and that's Joe Lindsay.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Joe Lindsay is terrific, in my opinion. I've seen enough of him. But Joe Lindsay has got 20 years in the SEC. He'll stay in the SEC. But Brian will identify the next guy or one or two guys that he thinks he can get over here as primary and do their schedule and be part of the ACC. But he has the luxury of having the ACC and be able to pay the top money in the country and make it attractive to guys. And he will. I mean, he's probably got some guys in mind already that he's identified with that he'll go after.
Anything you want to add, John, at the end of this 2017-2018 season of whistleblowers and also college basketball?
Nothing other than I think I've thoroughly enjoyed it. I look forward to continuing it. As a personal thing, I don't know what the NBA, the NCAA, and the people that are involved in college athletics, basketball-wise, the Danny Gavitts and people that kind of make these calls and Adam Silver, but it seems like there's a conversation every day about the one and dones, and do we go back to a different process and with the young kids that want to go to the NBA, or do they want to spend a year? Do they have to wait till they're a certain age before they can declare? I'm afraid, Luke, this is a person, I'm afraid we're building teams and not building programs, whether when we start taking one-and-dones who know they're going to be there 3 years, going to be there 1 year, and then we have a whole new group of players, whether it's two players or three players. But I just think smarter people than me figure out how to make this where a good player has an option to either go into the NBA or go to college. And I know there's options out there, Europe and the G League and so forth. But Marvin Bagley, a sensational player, was I don't believe was ever going to be more than 1 year at Duke.
No.
Okay. And if if he's a third pick this year, or the second pick or whatever, he would have been the first or second or third pick last year before he ever went to college. So why is we twisting Marvin Bagley's arm to go to college? Okay. And you could say that about some of the really, really premier players. I mean, the first guy taken was John Wall, who never went to college.
No, he went to Kentucky.
Oh, yeah, I apologize. He did go to Kentucky. Yeah. Maybe Allen Iverson was
Allen Iverson. Well, he went to Georgetown. LeBron James.
LeBron James, Kobe Bryant.
You know, neither of them played college.
Yeah, they've played. So that's just something that I hope that will change. I don't. Maybe it's a good thing. It's just a thorn in my side. When new kids come in, you forget about guys that were there just 1 year, and you don't hardly in a couple of years you don't even hardly remember them.
Yeah.
You know, you don't even remember how they contributed, but. Luke, I've enjoyed this. It's like sitting around and having a cup of coffee and talking basketball. What's better than that?
Nothing. And I'll just say, I had the same conversation with some sports writers the other day about it, the one and dones, how quickly they fade from your memory. And I'll just throw out a pitch for this. This is a column I've written several times, including last fall. You can find it. There's an easy fix to this, and that's the hockey model. You draft everybody at 18, and they can turn pro whenever they want. So your NBA team controls your rights, and you get so let's say Harry Giles from last year at Duke.
Harry Giles.
Okay. So here's a guy who at one point was going to be the number one pick in the draft before he got hurt. So at 18 he gets drafted after his senior high school. Let's say he gets drafted 16th overall. Some team says, well, they're not worried about him playing next year. He goes to Duke his freshman year. He's hurt for a lot of the year. Maybe he comes back to Duke for his sophomore year. Maybe he comes back to Duke for his junior year. But that's going to be a decision between Harry Giles and Duke and the Sacramento Kings or whoever drafts him. He's not required to turn pro. Now, a player like Bagley or Ben Simmons may get drafted at 18 and turn pro. That happens in the NHL with a Sidney Crosby or a John Tavares or whoever. But there are a lot of NHL players who, future NHL players like Jimmy Vesey of the Rangers, who were drafted, went to Harvard for 4 years, graduated, and at the end of that 4 years, he became a free agent and signed with the Rangers. So he had the freedom at that point.
Because he went
all
4 years.
So, you know, a player like Trey Duvall at Duke would have been drafted pretty high last year, I think, in a draft of 18-year-olds, would actually have seen his stock fall at Duke this year, and now would be able to come back to Duke potentially for his sophomore year, and you know you wouldn't be hustling these kids on to the next level.
And they can have agents and everybody.
They can have. They're called advisors, but yeah, they're all hockey agents, it's a system to me that works for the player, it works for the NBA, and it works for college teams. And you could have a guy who goes to college for a year and then signs with a G League team. Or you could have a guy who, you know, turns pro at 18. You just open up more options. You're not forcing kids to go to school for 2 or 3 years like you are with the baseball model. It becomes a collaborative decision-making process between team and player and college. And, it creates options, and it doesn't make anyone turn pro who's not ready to turn pro.
Yeah.
And it's good for the college game because talented players will stay in college longer. It's good for the NBA game because they will get players when they're ready to play in the NBA. And it's good for players because they don't have to gamble on getting drafted or gamble on going to the NBA. You know, that's not a decision they have to make at the end of the season. It's a decision they only make when it's a sure thing and there's a contract out there. So I strongly encourage if that sounds interesting to you, and if you're Condoleezza Rice listening to this podcast, and I know she is,
of course,
you know, go to the hockey model. That's going to work for everyone, and maybe you have to tweak it a little bit for basketball, but that's fine. To me, it's the way to go. And John, I've enjoyed this as well. Maybe next year we'll do it with beers instead of coffee, and see if it gets more entertaining.
Well, it'll definitely get more entertaining for you and I. We might be slurring our speech, but it'll be fun.
All right. Well, thanks, John, as always, for doing this. I've enjoyed it, and I hope everyone listening has. Thanks again. Maybe we'll do a special, get some guests together and do a special midsummer roundtable or something.
We ought to get Brian Kersey as our guest one time and get his insight on
this. Put him under the spotlight.
Yeah, we'll have plenty to ask him.
That sounds great. All right. Well, thank you for listening, everyone. And we will be back in the fall or maybe surprise everyone in the summer. But this has been two fun seasons of this, and we're looking forward to a third. Thanks for listening.
Thank you.